facts, opinions, controversies, current events, technology, the arts. How they affect you, your family, your friends, or your business depends on your point of view. Now it's time for Point of View, a weekly forum for insight and information of importance to the Chicago area. Produced by the news department of WNUA 95.5 Chicago.
Good morning. I'm Charlie Meyerson, and you're listening to the sax of a man billed as the hippest guy ever to serve in the White House. It says so in the news releases that accompany his new book. It's Leonard Garman, special consultant to Richard Nixon from 1969 to 1974, counsel to the president during the darkest days of Watergate, 1973 and 1974. What you may not know about Mr. Garman is his role in the history of jazz. Professional sax player for 3 years before launching a career as a lawyer, including a stint with the first big band ever to play bebop. It's part of the story Mr. Garman tells in his autobiography, Crazy Rhythm, My Journey from Brooklyn, Jazz, and Wall Street to Nixon's White House, Watergate, and beyond. Welcome to Point of View.
Great to be here.
Let's take it from the top. How'd you get into music?
Well, I grew up in part of Brooklyn, East New York, section of Brooklyn that happened to be a very sort of fertile ground for comics, jazz musicians, sort of the Mel Brooks types and Woody Allen later on nearby. But the jazz musicians were even more abundant. And I was drifting along in early high school days. I had started playing the clarinet just out of competition with a friend who had a clarinet. My brothers were Benny Goodman fans. Then from age of 13 to 15, I played whenever I could and imitated every one of the Benny Goodman solos that I had technical access to, that is, that I could manage. A fellow named Julius Gabenko, who later became Terry Gibbs, great fiber harpist, was in the neighborhood, lived in the neighborhood. Norman Tiny Kahn, great big drummer, used to carry Terry's vibes around, his drum set. The woods were full of musicians. And we'd walk around singing jazz tunes, and gradually I started to play club dates, for $3 or $4. We put together a band that won a band contest, and I became more interested in that than even the final couple of years at high school, and I started Brooklyn College. By then, I think I spent more time at the Brooklyn College Jazz Club than I did in any of my classes. And I got a job. I needed a job then. Family was busy trying to put all things together. And I got a job with the first band I worked with. I worked in on a rehearsal band, Henry Jerome's band, and they needed a tenor saxophonist. I'd been playing on 52nd Street, little pickup jobs. Just by accident, worked with Billie Holiday, with Bill Stegmaier's band. And I played with Al Haig, not the general, but the jazz pianist. So when I walked into that rehearsal studio, I had a little bit of a sense of what the whole scene was like, and I got the job. There wasn't anybody. A lot of the good musicians were now off in the armed services, so there was room for aggressive young players who weren't first water, high talent players. And went up to then every night of the week, except one, playing at Pelham Heath Inn all hours. Naturally, I wasn't a tiptoe full of energy at Brooklyn College. And I think I then just went to the jazz club. The long and short of it was, after about a year and a half, I flunked out of school, more or less waving the flag of rebellion and making a statement. I flunked everything, 5 courses, including music and hygiene, which somebody just told me the other day meant sort of sex education.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know. So various things didn't take. Music did take. And I started playing with bands full time And that's how I got into the music business.
We started the show with a bit of Gershwin. There's a Gershwin connection to your family.
Yes, my mother, who was an immigrant kid, 13 years old, came alone from a small, actually, I guess the city was Przemyśl in the southeastern Poland near the Russian border, and also, tragically, not very far from Auschwitz. First, one of the first jobs she had was at the Wallenstein and Gershwin restaurant on the Lower East Side. And as she tells the story, and of course the story grew in its detail as George Gershwin's fame grew. She was the sort of looked after young George more than Ira, intermittent babysitter for George Gershwin. And I suppose in a sense, when she was nurturing me about culture and values and all of that, a large part of that was music. It was within our family tradition. And George Gershwin had Rhapsody in Blue, and the clarinet, and the opening, the great glissando at the opening of Rhapsody in Blue. And there I was, playing that glissando when I was about 15.
Point of View on WNUA 95.5, Charlie Meyerson. Our guest is sax man, lawyer, former counsel to President Nixon, Leonard Garment. His autobiography is Crazy Rhythm. I want to hear more about those years and your role in the origin of big band bebop.
Came out of the service after a modest stint and needed a job.
This was when?
1944, fall of 44. And went back to my old band leader, and his band had broken up, and he was kind of singing the blues. And I needed a job, and I said, come on, Henry, let's try to put it back together again. And I had the idea then, because on the street for a few years, this new music, bop, the modern music, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Max Roach, Jay McShann's band was in town, and we were all running up there to Minton's and then to the clubs on 52nd Street to hear this fantastic super playing. And Al Cohn, great jazz tenor saxophonist, and I signed up with Henry's band. And we had the idea that the band would be transformed from a dance band to the first of the sort of modern jazz bop bands, transforming the small band bebop line into a big band line. It's complicated, but we moved in that direction. The band did well. We have air checks and all of that show the development, but Boyd Rayburn very shortly did the same thing and took a lot of the musicians from the band, and in a sense he got the historical credit until Ira Gittler wrote from Swing to Bop for Oxford Press and straightened out the historical record.
We have some highlights here, I know, from your days with the Henry Jerome Orchestra. Tell us what you've got, what we're going to hear.
What we have is a disc with four air checks from 1944-45. Features a little bit of me, a little bit of Ray Turner, a lot of Al Cohn, great jazz saxophonist, and you can't really hear him as a solo, but he's playing in the sax section, and that's Alan Greenspan, who's now the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board.
The Alan Greenspan?
The Alan Greenspan.
The sax man?
The sax man.
I didn't know that.
You may not believe it, but so buy the book, and there's a photograph of Alan and myself at Nola's rehearsal studio.
There is.
Now, the tune that I think would be most appropriate to play, I'm playing in the section, and the solo is by Al Cohn, who was, he's the man that drove me out of the music business because he was so good, and playing with him, I knew that there must be some greener pasture for my talents. And this is, it's a wonderful world. Al Cohn, age 17, and playing two solos, and they're pretty good if you're a jazz fan. Thank you.
It's a Wonderful World by the Henry Jerome Orchestra, featuring our guest today, the author of a book called Crazy Rhythm, My Journey from Brooklyn Jazz and Wall Street to Nixon's White House, Watergate, and Beyond. It's Leonard Garment.
Funny note, I've been on this book tour since San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, and in between. And I, you know, like other authors, I'd go in and check the location of the books. Was it there? Did they have it under the right name? And in at least half the bookstores, there was a problem locating the book because they filed it under jazz anthologies, which is fine, except that very few people go in looking for jazz anthologies. So, there I am, hidden way behind Mrs. Graham, playing my saxophone.
Well, how did you make the transition in your life from jazz to the law?
I mean, essentially,
it's a big jump.
Essentially, it was that I knew that I had been lucky enough to play with good musicians and smart enough to know that I couldn't be like them, and that if I was going to have a kind of a solid career, I would go back to school and try something else. So I went back to Brooklyn College. I went back to college. I had trouble getting back in. As a matter of fact, I went back in on probation since I had left on fairly inauspicious academic terms, and just worked very hard, kind of casting around trying to figure out what would it be. I had, as a kid, I thought about the law. And then I had I took a constitutional history course with Professor Konevsky, Sam Konevsky, who had just written a book on the life of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He was completely blind, and there was something about that and his judgment of the work that I did in the class that made me feel I was really getting a fair shake. It wasn't character. It wasn't kind of personality or the way I would talk, but what I produced on paper. And he called me in one day and said, well, you know, I'm quite sure that you should study law because you have a sense of what it's all about. I have I had a mimetic skill, pretty good ear, good enough ear to sound like a judge, not enough of an ear to sound like Lester Young. So I went to law school and got into a Wall Street law firm, feeling that, you know, this was sort of the whole assimilation process and upward and outward, and tried a lot of cases and became head of the litigation department after 15 or 16 years, kind of bored and thinking of going out and trying cases in a small firm. And along came Richard Nixon, joined the firm after his 1962 defeat. And because we had a client who was a friend of Nixon's and was the chairman of Warner Lambert Pharmaceutical Company, and he came. He was not a jazz fan, but he had a kind of a sense of music, and we had a kind of a sense of each other being a couple of kind of street kids in a way, and outsiders. We weren't part of the Wall Street elite, so we. You know, people say to me, "Did you like him when you met him?" I say, "Well, that's the wrong word. I was interested in him because he was sort of an escape hatch from a life that was kind of crushing me at that point. I just was bored."
And, as a lawyer.
Yeah, as a lawyer. And, you know, I still was playing. I'd play dates and I'd play weekends. I'd sneak off to the mountains for my vacation or off into the Berkshires and played with very good small groups. So there was always a constant pull between, you know, jazz and law and, you know, swinging and hanging. So he came. What's that song? You came, you were temptation. So there I was. I never became a Republican. I take this opportunity to correct the record on that. Yeah. And I told him, look, I'm an independent. I'm not even a Democrat anymore. He said, stay there. I got enough Republicans, and they're not exactly rocket scientists. So he had kind of the right sense of things. And what I liked about him, if you use the word like, was his intelligence. He was just smarter than hell, which made it very interesting. And that I got involved in what was a new lawsuit. It's called Running for the Presidency. It's essentially a forensic project without any procedural lines, and it has deteriorated terribly. Who wants to run for the White House now except persons who are fundamentally unstable? Not a happy place, and it's the anteroom of federal prison these days. So that's how I got involved. And the whole business wound up helping him with the campaign, wound up going to Washington, going into the government and doing a lot of things in the arts and humanities and civil rights, the things that I was interested in doing. Was not part of the inner circle, and therefore didn't see my stripe suits change in the other direction.
You have a daughter who's 16 now?
She's 15.
15, close to 16.
Move along, get toward 16.
Yeah. When did she start to ask you about Watergate? And I assume she has. And
she knows all about it.
Yeah, well, how did you first tell it to her? How did you tell it to a young child, your daughter?
Well, it was kind of a calamity of complexity of government, in which a president who did a lot of good things also allowed, acquiesced in, encouraged some bad things to be done, and got caught out for the bad things, lost his head, so to speak. And over a period of time, people began to see that there was a more balanced judgment about him, did some very important things, was a strong president. And she understands. She's very smart. I would say to Annie that it's very hard to be president without being very tough. You've got to be very tough. Even you have to have a capacity for real, visceral meanness, because you're dealing with a world that's just loaded with the enemies. I mean, it's a dangerous world, and these are the tyrant countries are run by mafiosi. I mean, they really, but they don't use little guns. They use large weapons, and so it is a tough place. Needs a tough leader who can convey message of seriousness, and Nixon had those qualities. He also was viscerally sympathetic to issues like help for the underdog. I mean, it's something that's coming to be known. Tom Wicker wrote a book. There's a whole revisionist school now that's beginning to recognize that a lot was done on the domestic side. National Cancer Institute, EPA, the Environmental Protection Administration, school desegregation, this, that, and the other thing. Just go, the list is very long. As a matter of fact, the criticism of Nixon by the conservatives is that he was an excessively progressive more liberal even than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So go figure it out. We'll see. 25 years from now, we'll be able to draw a clearer bead on what they all did against the kind of the epiphenomena of Watergate.
Point of view on WNUA 95.5. Charlie Meyerson talking to former counsel to President Nixon, a lawyer, and sax man, Leonard Garment. His autobiography is Crazy Rhythm. Now, you played a pivotal role in Watergate when it came time to decide what to do about the tapes.
I didn't play it. I played a role.
Well, tell us about it.
I was as counsel to the president when the tapes were revealed, and I hadn't heard the tapes, didn't know they existed until maybe week, 10 days before, when one of the president's men who did know came in to see me and said, what do I do if the Senate committee asks me about these things and describe what they were? I wasn't even terribly shocked. I assumed that they were tapes. I knew other presidents. They all taped. I didn't realize what did surprise me was that there was a constant taping system that functioned automatically. I told him, I told other people who were in that, the two or three other people who knew about the taping system, if you're questioned dead on, you got to answer it. You don't have to volunteer it, but don't dance around the subject. He almost wound up being indicted because he did a real tap dance. Then Alex Butterfield revealed the tapes, and that Monday when he was testifying, we were conferring, Al Haig, Fred Buzhardt, and myself. Fred was co-counsel on Watergate. The three of us about the tapes. If we could destroy them, how? Could we get them? Could we lay our hands on them? Secret Service had custody. If we did, what system would be used to destroy them? Very complicated. A lot of tapes. And
not easy to destroy.
And, you know, they had all those kind of showboat suggestions, take them out on the lawn and have a big bonfire. I mean, you'd have to file an environmental impact statement before you could do that. And because it was silly and showboating. And then who was going to light the flame? Because the president can't be indicted and tried. You have to impeach a president. But anybody else who does that kind of thing would be destroying evidence. So that discussion ended with a small joke. My great contribution, real contribution to history, was that King Timahoe, the president's dog, would light the fire. Then we could say the dog ate our lunch. You know. Then we went to see the president for a day and a half at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And we talked a lot. Basically, I went to say what would be the consequences of destruction of the tapes at the instruction of the president. And if they were destroyed, obstruction of justice, major felony, can't indict, try a president, certainly can't try a president, you have to impeach him, but this could be the first article in a bill of impeachment. That was my contribution. So I didn't say do it, don't do it. I said here are the consequences. Al Haig said the appearances would be certainly would be very bad, but he was more master of ceremonies. Fred Buzhardt said, I think Mr. Press said that if you can destroy them, there'd be a real ruckus for about 5 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, and then it would die down, and you'd be through with them, whatever they are. But then the president, the whole thing is academic. He called Bob Haldeman. Bob Haldeman had been fired a couple of months before because it was a kind of an albatross around the president's neck at that point. We got everybody was fired except the few of us who remained and started all over again. And he said, Bob, you heard the tapes. You heard the Dean Nixon tapes, the Watergate stuff, the March 21st Cancer on the Presidency tape. Should I keep them or destroy them? And Bob Haldeman, that's the great mystery, of one of the real great mysteries of Watergate, said, Mr. President, they are exculpatory, not incriminating. And they're your principal weapon against John Dean. If push comes to shove, he kept them. And that was probably the principal reason that he lost his presidency.
You would have destroyed them?
At that time, no. I mean,
you would have kept
them. What can I say? I mean, I didn't know enough about the strength of the presidency. It really can rock along through all kinds of storms. And you finally have to reach the point where you lose your support among your constituents in the Congress. They have to be threatened with the loss of their seats. Then they organize a deputation of the wise old men. They come to the president and they say, Mr. President, for the interest, the good of the country, they don't say, because we're concerned about our ASSs, you know, and jobs and so forth, but for the good of the country, we think that you should step down.
Any counsel from your historical perspective for Bill Clinton and his administration?
Oh, it's too
they fight.
No, they're into a different forest of complexity. You don't have tapes for one thing. You don't have a very nervous president for another thing, like Nixon, who managed to look guilty even when he was innocent. And you don't have a history of tremendous hatred of Clinton. As a matter of fact, he's kind of a likable guy. And you don't have anybody paying much attention to government these days because they figure they're all kind of by hook or crook they're going to get a lot of money. So I would say there would have to be a lot of things that happen, nuts and bolts attached to each other before the ultimate catastrophe happened to him, and I wouldn't hold my breath for that to happen unless you get a big surprise on, for example, on Hubble, Webb Hubble's case from the independent counsel Ken Starr.
You're going to take us out with something. What are we going to hear now?
Well, we'll hear a little bit of Tifa too on your son's saxophone.
Yes, he's very honored. Our guest on Point of View on WNUA 95.5, former counsel to the president, President Nixon, Leonard Garment, whose book is Crazy Rhythm, My Journey from Brooklyn, Jazz, and Wall Street to Nixon's White House, Watergate, and Beyond. 2750 from Times Books. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Thanks for tuning in.
This has been Point of View, a weekly forum for insight and information of importance to the Chicago area. The views expressed are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WNUA 95.5 or Evergreen Media Corporation. If you have any comments or questions, send them to WNUA News, Suite 300, 444 North Michigan, Chicago 60611. Our email address is WNUANews@AOL.com. Point of View is an exclusive presentation of the news department of WNUA 95.5, Chicago.